Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. I recently test drove a new product. It's umami paste in a tube, and it's called Taste Number 5. Now, umami's that protein in certain foods that makes everything it touches taste better. Well, Taste Number 5 made everything it touched taste worse. But there's an idea here. How about stocking up on umami ingredients like red wine, fish sauce, shiitake mushrooms, tomato paste, and Parmigiano-Reggiano cheese? Now, you don't need much. A tablespoon of Parmigiano in scrambled eggs, a drop of fish sauce in a salad dressing, a shot of red wine in a soup. These ingredients will do the heavy lifting for you. No tube required. So stay with us. There's more this hour on The Splendid Table. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Well, for whatever reason, we've all been struck by the DIY bug this year. We've been digging into vinegar, home-roasted coffee, cured pork, fresh cheeses. But have you considered chickens? Not for dinner, but for raising. I mean, lots of people, city people even, used to keep chickens behind apartment buildings. I mean, the tiniest yards in the burbs used to have chicken coops. Well, now the home-raised chicken is back. Chickens are in. And Jenna Wogenrich says nothing compares with waking up to the loving clucks of your own chicks. Well, Jenna's teaching herself homesteading. In the process, she's fallen hard for chickens. She knows what it truly takes to raise your own, and she lays it all out in a playful book, Chick Days, Raising Chickens from Hatchlings to Laying Hens. Jenna, good to have you here.
Well, thanks for having me.
You know, Jenna, this book is so funny. I realize you're talking seriously about raising chickens, but you write about these chickens the way somebody raves about how cuddly their golden retriever is. What is it with chickens?
Well, chickens are something I happened upon a couple of years ago when I found out a coworker in a corporate office kept 200 natural laying hens at her small farm as a side job from the work. So I fell in love with the idea of raising chickens even though I had an office job and started out with three. And I went into it thinking that these birds would be living avatars of the country life, just these little clucking kind of mindless beasts. But I learned pretty quick that they all have their own personalities and quirks and eating habits, and they get moody, they get sick, they get healthy. They're just small little animals, just like any other Pekingese or poodle in your home.
So how many do you have at this point?
Oh, my goodness. I think I have five roosters and about 22 laying hens.
All right, this is the big question. Do you have to have a rooster if you're going to have chickens? I mean, if you want to get chickens for eggs, do you have to start with a rooster?
No, not at all. Chickens are just like us in the fact that we will cycle through our own eggs whether or not we are dating someone. So chickens will lay an egg every day just like a human body will pass an egg every month. So it's not at all needed to have a rooster. They're enjoyable to hear, and they're delicious to eat, but you do not need one to have an egg.
I see. This is what I would like to do is, could you step us briefly through what we need to know to try this ourselves and maybe some of the things that you discovered that people do not tell you when you set out to do this?
Sure.
Okay. So how would you begin? What breed of bird, for instance, would you begin with?
I think anyone who's new to chickens is probably someone who lives in a more suburban or urban area. You're probably more familiar with them in a country setting. So you want a bird that's calm and quiet and doesn't make a fuss, And I think a breed like a Buff Orpington or a Brahma is a great first laying hen. They're good in most seasons, and they'll lay right through winter. And unlike other birds that can be a little more scrappy, they're very calm. They don't make a big fuss, and your neighbors will never know you even have chickens if you stick to those heavy laying breeds.
So a Buff Orpington and or a Brahma. And do they get on well together?
They do. They absolutely do. Just like us, if you cram a bunch of people into a tight space, they're going to get ornery after a while. But if everyone has enough elbow room and clean food and water, you're going to have some very happy omelets.
Okay. So now the next question is, exactly what do you need for the chickens? I mean, how much elbow room and what kind of equipment?
Not a lot. There are people who keep chickens in what used to be dog houses. They just kind of kicked out the dog or got a doghouse off Craigslist, put it up on a couple cinder blocks and gave it a little stairway up the door, and you instantly have a chicken house. They need a couple feet to move around. One nesting box is all you need in the doghouse or whatever it is you choose to keep as a backyard coop. And in an urban area, you'll probably have to have a pen so that they can't walk into the neighbor's yard or go on top of your building. But that's pretty much the long and short of it. You can scrap something together or get a used coop online, or you can simply order them. There's a company called Egloo who specializes in urban chicken houses, and they look like the 1990s IMAX, all colorful and plastic and dome-like, and they're just for three hens in your backyard.
Sounds like something I wouldn't mind to have in the house.
No, some folks have them in their garage, and there's people in Manhattan that keep chickens literally in the kitchen.
Well, how hard are they to actually keep in terms of keeping them healthy and also the cleaning up?
Okay, a basic chicken concern in your backyard, you're looking at about 10 minutes in the morning and 10 minutes at night. It's like having a stray cat you feed. It's not a lot of work at all. I always say if you can wait in line to buy a cup of coffee, you have enough time on your hands to raise chickens in your backyard, because it really is just morning feeding and checking their water and then coming back in the evening and doing the same and collecting any eggs they may have laid during the day. That's the long and short of it.
You really 20 minutes a day?
I would think so. I have a farm that keeps me really busy, and I doubt I spend more time on the chickens daily. On the weekends, you want to clean out the coop, and that might take half an hour. And you want to make sure you're spending time actually looking at your birds, making sure they're healthy and no one's coughing or sick, and you know there's been no sorts of maladies and such. But it's certainly a very small amount of time. Chickens are really self-sufficient themselves. If you give them a backyard, they will practically feed themselves off of ticks and bugs and grass.
Yeah, two things I've always been wondering about. First of all, what does pecking order really mean?
Pecking order means exactly that. The head bird will literally peck the skin on the back or the head of the birds it's bossing around. So, one of my blog readers asked me what to do about a hen who's just made herself the boss of the coop, and other birds are starting to look like, you know, war victims, and so she had to separate that bird from those animals. But it means just that. They're just like any group of people or dogs or horses. There's going to be one who's in charge.
And is it true that young hens lay little eggs, and as they get older, the eggs get larger?
Yes, that's one of the joys of keeping backyard chickens. In the grocery store, you never see the mini eggs. You only see the adult eggs, which are, you know, people want to buy as much food as possible. But when a hen starts laying, or a pullet starts laying, it's a young hen, it lays these little marbles, these little perfect little circles that slowly get bigger and bigger and become what we all know of as the egg in your palm. But watching that evolve and change, and some come out lumpy and some come out with extra calcium with little, you know, they look like little moon craters. And it takes a while to get to that thing you see when you open up a carton from the store.
And since you get one egg a day, and if you have maybe just three hens, you're not going to be overwhelmed and be giving your neighbors eggs every day.
No, I don't think so. And they have their off season too. Like a lot of birds slow down in the winter, or when they molt, they stop. So three hens probably would come to about a dozen and a half a week. And for a family that likes to bake, you're going to be just fine.
Well, Jenna, thanks for talking with us. And may your chickens continue to thrive.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Lynn.
Jenna Wogan-Rich's book is Chick Days, Raising Chickens from Hatchlings to Laying Hens. Now, her recipe three-hen quiche, that's just the number of eggs that you're going to get from three hens, is on the website, splendidtable.org. You know, some of my all-time favorite trivia questions come from the American Egg Board site. For instance, what makes brown eggs brown and what makes white eggs white? Well, in general, chickens with white earlobes lay white eggs and chickens with red or brown earlobes lay brown eggs. Of course, the real point is, who knew that chickens had earlobes? You know, I'm pretty sure that even if you have a wall of cookbooks, there's a couple that you always go to first. They're like old friends. They never disappoint you. Well, my go-tos include anything by food writer and actress Madhur Jaffrey. Madhur finished her 14th cookbook. It is At Home with Madhur Jaffrey, Simple Delectable Dishes from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka. Madhur, glad to have you back. It's been far too long.
I know, and it's always lovely to talk to you.
So I'm thinking about the Indian way with vegetables. Talk to me about what is done with greens, with the winter greens in India.
Well, I mean, I grow a lot of winter greens, so I do everything that is done with them in my home every single day. For example, you can make, let's say it's just a lunch you're thinking of.
Right,
you can make
right.
a lovely soup with Swiss chard and okra. Just think about it. That it's a lovely combination, and into it you put a little ground cumin, tiny bit of cayenne, and you can put chicken stock or vegetable stock, but the creaminess comes not from cream, but from coconut milk, which you can get in a can. So there you are. You have this lovely soup. Now, another thing that is done with, you know, people in this country associate collard greens with the South.
That's true.
But there is a state in India where collard greens are a staple. And indeed, through the course of the year, from spring to winter, because collard greens actually can last you into December, sometimes even into January, because they are hardy and they get only sweeter as the winter rolls along. So in the northern Indian state of Kashmir, where we have a severe winter, we have four seasons and there's snow. The climate is like New York pretty much.
Right.
We have these lovely collard greens that are eaten from spring until the late winter. And they have different names according to the season because they're very young and then they're very old and the older ones take longer to cook. And it is considered a staple to eat them with rice. You know, all the Indian states have totally different food. And we don't have that as a staple in any other part of India other than Kashmir. And the way of cooking them is very, very interesting. There are two ways of doing it. In Kashmir, you would use mustard oil. But if you can't get mustard oil, use a virgin olive oil because it gives the same kind of specialness and intensity that a mustard oil would. And then you can put either garlic, but in India, you would use asafoetida. And for those of you who don't know the spice, go run and get it. It's a digestive, it's a medicinal resin that comes off a tree that grows in Afghanistan, and it's crushed. And that is a digestive, the main reason for using it with greens, which sometimes for older people, sometimes they're hard to digest. You put a pinch of asafoetida. If you don't have it, use garlic. And that's all.
So you're sautéing?
No, actually, you sauté the spices. You put three dried hot chilies and the asafoetida. You sauté them for just a second. And then you put in all your greens and you can put in chicken stock or water, whichever you like.
Right.
And that's what they cook in. And you just eat them with rice. And even in Kashmir, the pot liquor is as important as it is in the South. And it's as valued. And you eat it with rice, so the rice absorbs some of the pot liquor. And it is a staple like rice and beans.
Right.
This would
right.
be the rice and beans of Kashmir.
And you mentioned something when we were talking a while ago about cornbread being used with collards as well.
That is a staple in the state of Punjab,
which
is
Punjab.
Also in North India, but it's not as cold as Kashmir, south of Kashmir.
Right.
And there, the staple in the winter is mustard greens eaten with cornbread. But these are like tortillas. They're flat cornbreads. But I was just thinking, they would be just as nice with cornbread made the American way, because it's the same use of corn. And the greens, they just cook the greens with green chilies, a few chopped up green chilies. They cook it till it's really soft, and then they pulverize it with like a potato masher. Not very fine, but just not in a blender, but just coarsely pounded. Then separately, they cook onion, garlic, ginger, tomatoes. And they mash all that up and mix it with the greens. And then they eat it with the cornbread. It's so good.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
I can't tell you.
You know, there's techniques here that are very interesting that, you know, I'm thinking about if you take the idea or the concept behind the dish, that the way it's done in India, you can apply it to other things as well, other vegetables.
Absolutely.
Sounds delicious. Mater, thank you.
Thank you.
Mater Jaffrey's latest film is today's special, and her new book is At Home with Mater Jaffrey. Now, that recipe, Kashmiri-style collard greens, it's up on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, we're going to be back in a moment with the chef of what some call the best restaurant in the world. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. There are restaurant awards all over the place, and then there are a few that people actually pay attention to. Every year, the San Pellegrino Mineral Water people name the 50 best restaurants in the world. They poll the high echelons of the food world for the choices. And out of that 50, one place is named the best restaurant on earth. And it's usually one from France or Spain or England or the United States. But not this year. The best restaurant on earth for 2010 is in Copenhagen, Denmark. It is Noma, and it is the creation of 31-year-old chef René Redzepi. Now, his CV includes working with a lineup of great food minds from Spain and France and the United States. But what he cooks at Noma is like nothing you'd eat anywhere else. It's meticulously local. Now, we're talking Denmark. Not the easiest place to source local food. Well, René Redzepi's new book is Noma, Time and Place in Nordic Cuisine. René, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Did you have any idea that Noma was going to take you to this place?
No. No, I for sure didn't. Of course, when starting out in the as a chef, you dream that one day perhaps you can inspire people and you will have a restaurant and cook some food that can have something to say out there, perhaps in your city, in your country, and if you're really lucky in the world. But that was just a dream that it, in fact, were to happen. I never expected.
Well, you know, from the outside looking in, you're coming from a place where traditionally people have not had a lot to work with. Or is that not true?
See, that's the thing, that because it's not true. We've had a period in our country, and I think this goes on many places around the world, where you are somehow just blind to what is truly out there of ingredients and diversity. And we found out as we were researching and going into depth, we found a richness and diversity that we just didn't know existed.
You kept a diary. You did a trip.
Yeah.
It sounded like you were following the Vikings. I mean, you were in the Faroe Islands, you were in Iceland, you were in Greenland, and you were researching for the restaurant. That diary is so vivid. What did you find?
Oh, well, this was the beginning of everything. You know, the notion of let's do a restaurant where we try to incorporate our regional produce was of course an easy thought. Well, is there enough produce? We simply didn't know. That journey was the instigator of everything. We told ourselves that we will work only with our own natural ingredients. But I think it's important to say that just because you do that, work locally, a cuisine doesn't necessarily come out of it. If you do a crème brûlée, even though you put huckleberries in it from here, it's the culture of the dish still belongs somewhere else. So So that was quite difficult. And in our research on all these produce and all these products and working locally, there was a whole new discovery of a culture as well, of trying to find out why we eat the way we do, and why is it, in fact, that we haven't had a highly developed gastronomical culture before.
Now, Renee, on that trip, was there one thing or two things that you discovered that really stood out for you?
I would say the first time I tasted sea buckthorn was a revelation to me.
What is it?
This is a small orange berry. It's acidic, astringent. It's delicious. It can be quite sour, full of C vitamin. And this is a berry that can be used in just any part of cuisine. Savory, sweet. It can be dried. It's just such a diverse berry. You juice it and there's tons of pectin in it. You can make, you know, gels of it and so on and so on. And it has a small note of something exotic, like passion fruit or mango. And of course, as a Scandinavian, where you think, well, our fruits are perhaps plums and apples and berries, and and this exoticness doesn't exist here. That was a very big surprise. And you know, of course, as well, something that told me that there's more out there to be found.
Can you take that or one of the other discoveries and sort of walk us through how one of the dishes that you do, how you get there?
One dish that we could talk about is a dish that involves a forest. And usually if you have any type of tree, you use the nuts, the walnuts, the hazelnuts, and so on. And, you know, in North America, of course, you do the zap maple syrup. And we have a lot of birch trees in our region. So we simply asked ourselves, how does the wood taste? How's the bark? And we tried doing a broth of it.
Uh-huh.
Very, very simple. You can actually infuse the wood flavor into stocks or water if you like it. Very simple. And the dish we ended up doing with this broth was we wanted to have a complete little forest onto a plate.
Uh-huh.
So it became chanterelles that are just simply sautéed.
Right,
with
mushrooms.
Finely, finely shaved hazelnuts.
Huh.
You know, fresh hazelnuts. They're almost like fresh almonds, milky and extraordinary, crunchy.
Right.
And they don't have this dried flavor. They're a complete different sensation than a dried hazelnuts. You shave them thin over so it covers all these chanterelles and it gives texture to the dish and enriches it a bit. And, of course, I believe that chanterelles do, in fact, have a bit of nutty flavor once roasted.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have this birch water broth or birch wood broth, the wood infused into the broth, creating something, a very special flavor that you somehow recognize, because it's almost as if you're walking through a forest and smelling the forest. It sounds crazy. So you're recognizing it and you're eating it, and there's a tartness and almost a tannicness to it, but still deliciousness and acidity, natural acidity and a little bit of sweetness as well.
Oh, my. Well, Renee, I really appreciate your talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chef Renee Redzepi is author of Noma, Time and Place in Nordic Cuisine. His recipe for chicken skin with rye bread, smoked cheese, and lumpfish roe is on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to register to possibly win a copy of your very own. You know, this book is really quite a wonder. You absolutely get inside of his head, and you really see how he draws on this world of Nordic ingredients. We know nothing about this. So, you know where to go, splendidtable.org. Say you have Chinese takeout. General Tso's chicken, stir-fried bok choy, fried pork dumplings with vinegar sauce. What would you drink? Well, beer would cover the bases, but wine is the tough one. Well, here to help is Edwin Soon. He's author of Pairing Wine with Asian Foods, and he joins us from Singapore. Edwin, welcome.
Thank you.
So we're talking about pairing wine with some of the most difficult flavors for wine I can think of. I mean, most Asian dishes aren't wine-friendly, are they?
No, not really, because you're talking about a whole host of different new flavors as compared to, let's say, Western food. For example, you've got strong pungent flavors. You've got the burn from the chili. Sometimes you've got the sourness from vinegar and limes. And to add to that, a lot of Asian food uses fermented ingredients, for example, kimchi or fermented bean curd. So you're looking at lots of different tastes that you have to deal with when you're pairing wine with Asian food.
Are those, I mean, if you had to pick the top four most difficult flavors to pair with wine, would those be it? I mean, the sour, the funky fermented?
I would say it'd be the chili. With chili, I think you want to be really careful about the kind of wine you serve up. Because, for example, if you serve up tannic red wine, it might just aggravate more of the chili flavors. Or if you serve something that's a bit alcoholic, alcohol gives a slight burn, and to add to the chili burn, you end up with a big fine in your mouth.
What would you pair with chili, with the chili dish?
The best wine for chili would be something a little sweet, because sweetness in a wine will quell the chili and soothe the burn. In Asia, for example, when you go out on the street and you see people eating really chili hot food, what they have by their side normally is a sweet drink. And in the same way, if you want to serve wine, pick a lightly sweet wine, say a Moscato. You could even use a syrupy sweet wine such as ice wine or late harvest wine.
Really? You could go that far?
Yeah.
Well, let's take the menu I talked about, the takeout menu. What would you pair with it? Now, we have the General Tso's chicken. We have the stir-fried bok choy, which is kind of neutral, soy sauce. The other dish is spicy. Then the pan-fried pork dumplings with a vinegar dipping sauce. So what would you work with those?
Okay, let's start with the General Tso's chicken, right?
Right.
It's sweet and spicy. So I would go with a juicy wine. You don't have to stick to whites. You could serve a juicy red wine such as a Grenache. And it's also, you want to pick a wine with low tannins. So you could also use a Beaujolais or Gamay wines. And also lightly sweet wines would work with this chicken dish.
Okay, so you could go red, you could do white, could you do like a Chenin Blanc or something?
You could. There are some Chenin Blancs that are lightly sweet. And they might work, too.
Okay. So what about the bok choy, which would probably be with a bit of soy sauce, a little ginger, a little garlic?
Oh, that's pretty common dish that you find.
Yeah.
I would go with a light white on medium white. You could even go with a Chardonnay. Well, bok choy would, like many dishes, would be stir-fried. So you've got a little bit of that wok char flavor. So you've got a little bit of smokiness. And so you might want to pick a wine which is a little nutty, a little smoky. So a white wine aged in oak would mirror those flavors.
So that would mean that, for instance, a vegetable stir fry that's not heavily seasoned, that's rather delicate, you could do that Chardonnay with oak.
You certainly could.
Now the pan-fried pork dumplings with a vinegar dipping sauce, you know, the combination of the vinegar and the soy sauce. We love that kind of thing, but that's tricky with wine when you get into vinegar. Right.
Okay, that's tricky. If you serve a wine that's sweeter than the sourness in the dish, then you're okay. But if your dish is sour, and if your wine is not sweeter than the dish, then the wine will taste sour.
Okay.
And no one wants to drink a sour wine. So you could go with an Asti. Sometimes you could venture a red wine with low tannin, such as a Pinot Noir. If it's got some residual sweetness.
So when you say Asti Spumante, right, you're
yeah.
talking bubbles and you're talking pretty sweet.
Yeah, medium sweet. You know, one dish, and I didn't come up with this, I was amazed. I went to this party and the host insisted on serving some wines with Korean ginseng soup. And I said, wow, liquid with liquid, how's this going to work?
Uh-huh.
Amazingly, we found that Asti worked with it because it was a match on different levels. For example, you had the hot, the warm soup and the cool wine. You had the still soup and the wine with bubbles. So you're sort of contrasting the textures.
Yeah.
And then you've got your salty, savory flavors of the soup and the sweet wine. And it turned out quite nice.
So it sounds like the lightly sweet wine is the one to go with a lot of the seasonings, the extreme
seasoning. Yes, that's my favorite when in doubt wine to go with Asian food, something that's lightly sweet.
Edwin, thanks for talking with us.
You're most welcome.
Edwin Soon is the author of Pairing Wine with Asian Food. Now, you can find a list of his favorite wines for Asian flavors and a recipe from us for a spiced wine syrup that you can use, by the way, on anything from glazing a roast chicken to making a grown-up sundae. And it's a good way to use up leftover wine. All of that's on the website, splendidtable.org. Jane and Michael Stern trek across America finding local eateries worth the journey. Now, they report into their road food site and to us here. Jane, Michael, good to have you back. So where have you been wandering?
We have been wandering in Cincinnati, Ohio, and one of the places we wander to, like a magnet, is Hathaway's Coffee Shop downtown. It's one of those old-fashioned downtown coffee shops that every city used to have. They don't anymore. And I just need to explain right away that when I say coffee shop, I am not talking about coffee house. You know, in the Starbucks era, the two terms are kind of conflated, but
yeah,
they're totally different. A coffee house, you know, like Starbucks, is all about coffee. And you get, you know, you pay one price, you get one cup of coffee. In a coffee shop, you pay for the coffee and they keep filling up your cup.
I think that the popular culture coffee shop that everybody may remember is in Seinfeld, where the whole gang always goes, and it's the New York Luncheonette.
Yeah, it's kind of like a more slightly upscale diner. And the fact is that in a coffee shop, unlike a coffee house, there's a full menu. And you can have a wonderful hot lunch. You usually can get breakfast. And that's what a coffee shop is all about. And Hathaway's Coffee Shop in Cincinnati is one of the greats.
So what makes it so great?
First of all, I think the architecture or the decor. I mean, you sit at a serpentine counter. I mean, there are some tables and booths, but the place to sit is at a counter. That's so the waitress can fill up your coffee after every three sips. I mean, the cup is never down more than an inch.
So it's always hot. It's always hot.
It's always hot. The other thing is that they just serve a wonderful hot lunch, a great breakfast where you can get not only bacon and eggs and hash browns, but that Cincinnati specialty, Geta, you know, which is the pork and pin oat loaf, vaguely similar to scrapple, but in my opinion, much better.
Oh, yeah. It's almost like a meatloaf. Mm-hmm. It's pan-fried by the slice, and
yep,
it's really wonderful.
It's delicious.
Pan-fried. And the way they do, I mean, it can be pan-fried poorly. The way they do it at Hathaway's is the outside gets nice and crisp and crunchy, but it's just thick enough so the inside is really moist and juicy. I mean, it's a wonderful piece of breakfast meat.
So is downtown Cincinnati, I mean, is really thriving these days?
Hathaway certainly is thriving. It seemed pretty much so. You know, we were traveling around eating a Met on every corner. You know what a Met is?
No, what's a Met?
M-E-T-T. On our way to Cincinnati, people were saying, oh, you got to have the Mets. I had no idea what they were talking about until it was explained to me that Met is short for Metwurst. And, you know, Cincinnati being a very sort of German ancestor town. In fact, it used to be called Porkopolis because they packed more pork than any city in the world. They still have these old-time butcher shops that make Metwurst, which are smoked and cured sausages, vaguely similar to a bratwurst, but much smokier and also kind of coarser grind. And they're really delicious. They're served in hot dog buns, but way better than most hot dogs.
So are they actually sold on street corners?
I mean, yeah, street corners. You can get a regular Met. You can get a cheese Met. You can get an extra spicy hot Met. And these are all ones that have been made probably in the last few days by a local butcher.
Oh, this, you know, I remember being in Cincinnati, the farmer's market is to die for.
Isn't yes, it amazing?
And there's
yes,
a butcher in it. It's an indoor market and, you know, it's permanent. There's a butcher.
I know the butcher you mean.
Oh, boy. His Geta is just not to be believed. So you have coffee, you have Geta, you go to the yeah, market, and then you eat
you
Mets.
Have Mets.
Yeah. Okay. We've covered it. Guys, thank you.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
The Stern's most recent guide to hedonism is 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Now, check out their latest restaurant picks on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it is time for this week's trivia challenge.
And the question is, which country has the oldest wine tradition? Well, we're going to be back with the answer, and you and I are going to talk. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be taking your calls and emails in a minute. You can get in touch, tweet, connect with us on Facebook, or give us a call, 800-537-5252. But for right now, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, which country has the oldest wine tradition? Well, the country is China. 9,000 years ago, China was fermenting a wine from rice. It was flavored with honey and fruit. Grape wine was the latecomer. Grape fermentation started 7,400 years ago in the mountains of Iran. But the latest in archaeology and the grape is the discovery of the oldest known winery from 6,100 years back. Now, this came from the Wall Street Journal. In a cave in Armenia, archaeologists found a wine press and shards of pottery that had pigments of a red wine grape. But here's the kicker. That grape is still making wines today. It is the Vitis vinifera vinifera, cultivated since 4000 BC. I mean, you talk about a great vintage.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but just call me.
Let's you and me talk. The lines are open. Give us a call at 800-537-5252. Send us an email, splendidtable.org, or go to Facebook. We have Nate on the line from Portland, Oregon. Nate, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. My girlfriend has been looking for a popover tin for probably the better part of a decade. Every single cookware shop we go by that she hasn't been in yet, she goes in and asks if they have a, quote, stainless steel, non-stick popover tin.
Right.
Now, I couldn't identify a popover in a lineup, but I would love to get something like this for her for her birthday, which is coming up in a few months, and I would get all of the boyfriend points.
All right. Well, first of all, the difference between a popover tin and a muffin tin, you know when you make muffins or cupcakes, is that the popover tin, the indentations are deeper. You know, in so many words, they're a little taller. They're almost shaped like a small flower pot. You know, they flare and they're deeper. And I remember seeing them where they were actually, you know, the tin was really a very, very heavy wire, for lack of a better term, that was holding eight of those cups, you know, two lengths of four. Very sturdy. All right. Have you looked online? I mean, have you gone to places like Williams-Sonoma, Chef Shop, Cook's? I mean, there's a Chef's Choice. Have you checked out, you know, specialty cookware sites?
I've done a little bit, and all I can seem to find are either aluminum.
Ah, but she wants a stainless steel exterior, and she wants...
She doesn't want the nonstick coating. That's the kicker.
Okay.
I think she'd be happy if she could just find a cast iron version.
Oh, well, there have to be cast iron versions. Absolutely there has to be cast iron versions because this thing has been made, popovers have been made forever.
Okay. You would think.
All right. There are two prime companies that do cast iron. One is Lodge, L-O-D-G-E, and the other one, is it Griswold? I think it might be Griswold. Anyway, they're two of the oldest makers of cast iron. And they've got very traditional shapes. Now, the other thing is, I wonder if the Yankee Country Store site might be able to help you. Have you been to Sur la Table?
S-U-R, and then L-A, and then the word table.
No, I have not.
Okay, they are like Williams-Sonoma. They have a lot of stuff.
Perfect.
And I think they'd be a good place to go. But look at either, I think it's Griswold, and look at Lodge for cast iron, because that's all they make. Okay.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay, so I hope that helps, because it's like, what a lovely thing to do for her.
Oh, my gosh. If I could find one, she would be over the moon. And, you know, I figure I'll get some popovers out of it. So.
Oh, you sure will. And, boy, have you had a popover?
Not at all. Not
oh,
ever.
Oh, 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 brace yourself. You're going to fall in love with her all over again.
Trust
me.
I do every day.
Hey, Nate, good luck with it.
Oh, thank you so much.
You are welcome. You can call us 800-537-5252. We've got Vanessa calling from Eugene, Oregon. Vanessa, hi. What's on your mind, ma'am?
Hi, Lynn. Thank you for taking my call.
You are welcome.
I was given a bottle of macadamia nut oil.
Yeah.
And I use olive oil all the time, but I'm not familiar with nut oils. And all I can think of to do with it is a salad dressing or something like that. But there must be something not only more imaginative than that, but something that will bring out its flavor
well,
to its best extent.
Have you tasted it yet?
Yes.
What does it taste
like? It's light. It's nutty. It has great flavor. I don't really know how to describe it. It's different than olive oil.
Well, you know, macadamia nuts are very high in oil, and
mm-hmm.
they do have that almost a sweetness to them.
Mm-hmm.
Does the oil have that quality?
It does.
This is what I would do. This is what I would do. You could use it the way you would use what they call finishing oils, you know, the very fine olive oils.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You make a piece of fish, drizzle a little on after cooking.
Okay.
You're going to mash potatoes because the potato is this great neutral, you know, that can take on other flavors brilliantly
mm-hmm.
and be a carrier. Drizzle some of that oil with some coarse salt into a baked potato.
Okay.
It'd be really fabulous. Try tossing it with rice noodles and some fresh mint and fresh coriander and maybe some chopped up water chestnuts and a few cucumbers.
Hmm. I never would have thought of that.
Yeah, but I'm thinking Asian because, you mm-hmm. know, there's such an Asian influence. These are from Hawaii. And
right.
there's such an Asian influence in Hawaii. It's not even influence. It's a bedrock
mm-hmm.
of Hawaiian food. And this has an Asian overtone to it. So you could do a sort of rice noodle salad. You wouldn't need a lot of it. And if you want to have a little accent of acid, you'd use perhaps a little bit of fresh lime.
Okay.
And that would be great.
Yeah.
And then I would think about, you know, sort of delicately flavored foods. Steamed rice.
Mm-hmm.
Roasted chicken. Why not just spread some of it on a piece of bread that you've toasted? No, but
why
I'm
not?
Thinking
then
instead,
you'll get the full flavor.
Yeah, I mean, you'll get the full flavor. The bread should be, you know, it could be a whole grain, but it really should be something kind of neutral. I would do maybe a white baguette.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe top that with some crushed, salted macadamia nuts.
Mm.
Wouldn't that be kind of cool?
Mm-hmm.
I think that'd be kind of fun. And you know the other thing to try? Why not try mixing it with a little bit of sugar or honey? I think, no, sugar's more neutral. And drizzling it over something creamy, like vanilla ice cream. I know
that
it sounds
good.
Weird, but I have to tell you, really sweet, delicious olive oil is great on vanilla ice cream.
No, actually, there's a restaurant here that serves ice cream with tangerine olive oil, and it's delicious.
Yeah, so there you go.
That's another great idea I never would have thought of on my own.
Wherever an expensive, highly flavored olive oil is used, you can use this.
Okay.
You know, the other thing is, wonder what it would be like on fresh pineapple.
Mm.
Not bad to try, at least.
Oh, that's worth trying, definitely.
Oh,
thanks
well,
for the great ideas.
You are welcome. And by the way, I would think I would keep it in the refrigerator just to be on the safe side, because
mm-hmm.
sometimes those oils are really fragile. And it's a
it
good idea.
In the refrigerator, awaiting my next use of it. Thank you very much.
Go forth and adventure, Vanessa.
Thanks a lot.
You take care.
You
bye.
You too. Bye.
800-537-5252. You know, while I'm thinking about it, there's a flavored oil you can make, and it takes literally 90 seconds, okay? Take a decent flavored olive oil, add whatever fresh herb you like. So, for instance, if you had a quarter cup of the olive oil, you'd want to add a teaspoon of, let's say, fresh thyme or broken up basil leaves, and you put that in the microwave for 1 minute, and you've got a flavored oil.
And you never store flavored oils because you can get problems with them. They can develop botulism. But you can make a really delicious tasting flavored oil in 1 minute. So you don't need to store it. And they taste wonderful. And you can drizzle that on anything you want to. You can make those kind of fancy pools that you see in restaurants on the plate. And then you can drag your veggies for dinner through it. Anyway, call us, 800-537-5252. Camille is calling from Los Angeles. Camille, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn.
Hello. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I really love playing with interesting ingredients. So recently, my husband brought me this big basket of fun stuff from a market in Little Tokyo.
Ooh.
And, yeah, it was great. And most of it I either recognized or I could taste it and figure out basically what was in it, except for one jar.
What was the jar?
It said coconut fin sauce on it. And
wait, say that again? Coconut?
Coconut fin sauce.
Thin as in thin, small.
Yes.
Okay.
And it smells and tastes like motor oil with sugar in it.
Oh. I wonder if it's sort of over-the-hill coconut oil. Oh, dear. I have to tell you, I'm not familiar with this at all. But, you know, there is a woman named Elizabeth Andow. She did a cookbook called Washoku, and she's done other books on Japanese food, but Washoku is one of them. And she might have a website that would have information. And the other thing is, go to something like the Japanese Cultural Institute. The sites that are going to be, they're usually going to be .orgs. You know, they're not selling you anything. And they're usually ones that are going to deal with culture. And see what you can find out about this. This just might be not one of the great classic ingredients, but something that someone made up that, you know, you can use in a variety of ways.
Okay.
But I wonder, you know, it's like here, if somebody were to come to the United States and had never seen hot sauces before, they might think that, you know, the 400 hot sauces that are in some places are very, very American. Well, maybe they are, but they also might be very Mexican, or they might be just someone's idea of their own hot sauce. So maybe you don't have to use coconut flavored motor oil in your food. You know, even though it may be authentic and wonderful and from Japan or anywhere else, it doesn't mean we have to like it and use it.
Okay. I was feeling guilty that I couldn't appreciate it, can figure out anything to use it in.
I have to say, get over the guilt. Just don't worry. Move on.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Camille. Take care.
You too.
Bye. You know, before the word lifestyle had a life of its own, there was Sunset Magazine. And if you don't know about Sunset, you probably have lived your life east of New Mexico. This was the magazine of the West, where you could learn how to build your own composter or your own cabin and cook California cuisine before Alice Waters was out of her sandbox. Well, the Sunset Cookbook is now in print, and we have Sunset's food editor and the book's editor, Margot True, with us. Margot, welcome.
I'm pleased to be here.
So Sunset, I mean, I always looked at that magazine, I think I was a kid, and thinking it was about this wondrous place called California. but I mean, California felt that way.
Yes, for a lot of people moving west, it was that. It was sunshine. It was a whole new place to reinvent oneself, too. You could leave behind all the traditions and expectations and be what you wanted to be.
Where did Sunset begin? I mean, how did it start?
Well, it actually started in 1898, and it was can you believe it? It was a PR publication put out by the Southern Pacific Railroad to publicize its very fancy train called the Sunset Limited, which took people from the Midwest, from New Orleans specifically, through New Mexico and Arizona, over to L.A., and then up to San Francisco, and it ran two times a week. And the owners decided that because they also were the largest landowner in California and Nevada, that they would publish a little magazine that would sing the glories of the West and why you should move there and buy land. And so they put out this little 16-page pamphlet called Sunset. And it was all about Yosemite, and the cover is of the Golden Gate before the Golden Gate Bridge.
So the food traditions then that the magazine had were really very localized. They were about what was there.
They were all about what was here. In fact, the very first recipe in Sunset, believe it or not, was for chayote squash because it grew here, and East Coasters and Westerners had never, you know, seen this item. And it was all about how to cook an artichoke, you know, what to do with an avocado. In fact, even in 1970, people weren't really sure what avocados were or what to do with them. Judging from our coverage, we had this great story that had this subhead that went, it's endlessly versatile. It's a dip, a sauce, a dressing, a spread. It's guacamole in italics. You know, it was wonderful. Sunset was constantly introducing people to the foods of the West. And it didn't take long for it to spread beyond California to the coverage area it now has today, which is essentially everything west of the Rockies.
I think it would be great to be able to dig into all of those old copies because you'd be tracing the history of the West. Margo, thank you.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
Margo True is food editor of Sunset Magazine and editor of the Sunset Cookbook. For a little West Coast-inspired cuisine, go to the website for Sunset's halibut kebabs with grilled bread and pancetta. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for being with us. And remember, you can reach us any way you want. Tweet, Facebook, and email. Go to splendidtable.org or actually pick up the phone. 800-537-5252. Until next time, let me leave you with this from Jay Trachman, who said, "The formula for a happy marriage? Well, it's the same as the one for living in California. Whenever you find a fault, don't dwell on it." Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. Now, you're going to find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Sarah Lear and Roger Miller. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. Well, we're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.